Welcome to Washington Today for April 11th, 2022. I'm Gary Starikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Here are some of your headlines. President Biden announced at the White House today new regulations that include a crackdown on so-called ghost guns. He also announced the nomination of Steve Dettelbach, a former U.S. attorney in Ohio, to head the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We'll take you to that event coming up. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is asking South Korea for military aid. In a video address to the South Korean parliament, President Zelensky asked for tanks, ships, and anti-missile equipment. He also talked about the conditions in the city of Mariupol, saying there are tens of thousands of people dead there. More on that coming up. 72 people have now tested positive for COVID-19 after having attended the Gridiron Dinner here in Washington last weekend. It includes members of the Biden administration, reporters, and six new positive test announcements from House members. They include Democrats Roger Krishnamoorthy of Illinois, Earl Blumenauer of Oregon, Frank Pallone of New Jersey, Lisa Blunt Rochester of Delaware, Elaine Luria of Virginia, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced late this afternoon on Twitter that she has tested negative for the virus and will exit isolation on Tuesday. We'll hear from new White House COVID response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha coming up. The nation's average gasoline price dropped about 8 cents over the past week and about 13 cents over the last 2 weeks. That's according to figures from AAA. Average prices now stand at $4.11 per gallon, down from $4.19 a week ago and $4.24 2 weeks ago. The recent drop comes after the U.S. and several countries announced that they would release additional oil from their reserves. U.S. crude oil prices stood at around $95 per barrel on Monday morning, down from as high as $103 per barrel a week ago, and even higher in late March. We begin at the White House, where President Biden announced a new firearm regulation meant to contain the use of privately made weapons, or so-called ghost guns. The regulation will require background checks before purchase and serial numbers on some of the components. Although ghost guns make up a relatively small share of the guns recovered by law enforcement, they have been seen with increasing frequency in recent years. Here's Mia Tretta, who was shot and wounded with a ghost gun in a school shooting in California in 2019. She introduced the president at today's Rose Garden event.
When I woke up on November 14th, 2019, my biggest worry of the day was a Spanish test. I was a freshman at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita, California, determined to get good grades. So as soon as I got to school, I made a beeline for the quad to meet up with my best friend, Dominic Blackwell. It's hard for me to talk about Dominic. Like me, Dominic had big dreams, like doing well in school and planning for our futures. We spent the morning like any other, laughing, talking, until we heard a loud pop. It was a gunshot, followed by six more. One of the bullets hit me in the stomach. Somehow, I was able to get up and run away. But Dominic couldn't. I was airlifted to the hospital and spent hours in surgery having a bullet removed from my abdomen that was millimeters away from my major artery. Then my parents told me the terrible truth. Dominic had died, and so had another classmate, Gracie Ann Muehlberger, a 15-year-old girl with an infectious laugh. And a community was left shattered. I later learned that we had been shot by a 16-year-old student for reasons I will never know. He had brought his father's weapon to school, a firearm I would come to know as a ghost gun. Ghost guns are untraceable, build-it-yourself firearms that look like a gun, shoot like a gun, and kill like a gun, but have not been regulated like a gun. I've also learned that as a student, I don't just have to worry about Spanish tests, but about my life. School shootings with ghost guns are on the rise. And the most lasting thing I have learned, other than the loss of friends or the shattering of my youth, is that nothing has relieved the pain in my heart like working to prevent more senseless shootings. So my family and I joined Everytown for Gun Safety, Moms Demand Action, and Students Demand Action. And we worked with thousands of other young activists and survivors to prevent more things like this happening. They turned my pain into progress. And that's why we're here today.
That's Mia Tretta, who survived a shooting at her California high school by a student with a ghost gun, speaking at the White House. Now, generally, guns made by licensed companies are required to have serial numbers, typically displayed on the frame of the gun, and they allow officials to trace the gun back to the manufacturer, the firearms dealer, and the original purchaser. But ghost guns are privately made firearms. They are untraceable and don't have serial numbers. The White House says that its new proposal requires dealers to stamp serial numbers on the ghost guns, and it will help drive down violent crime and aid investigators in solving crime. Here's President Biden with more.
The gun lobby tried to tie up the regulators and paperwork for a long, long time. The NRA called this rule, I'm about to announce, extreme. Extreme. But let me ask you, is it extreme to protect police officers, extreme to protect our children, extreme to keep guns out of the hands of people who couldn't even pass a background check? Look, the idea that someone on the terrorist list could purchase one of these guns. It's extreme. It isn't extreme, just basic common sense. You know, if you buy a couch, you have to assemble. It's still a couch. If you order a package like this one over here that includes the parts you need, the direction of assembling a functioning firearm, you bought a gun. Take a look. Package. You can see the picture down here, maybe. This is the gun. It's not hard to put together. It's a little drill, hand drill at home. It doesn't take very long. Anyone can order it in the mail. Anyone. Folks, a felon, a terrorist, a domestic abuser can go from a gun kit to a gun as little as 30 minutes. Buyers aren't required to pass background checks because guns have no serial numbers, these guns. When they show up at a crime scene, they can't be traced. Harder to find and prove who used them. Meaning you can't connect the gun to the shooter and hold them accountable. In fact, the ATF reports that they've been able to trace less than 1% of ghost guns reported by law enforcement. So it makes sense that police across the country are increasingly finding ghost guns at crime scenes. And by the way, ghost guns can be, quote, rifles, essentially assault weapons as well. This is just one version of the kit you can buy. Last year alone, law enforcement reported approximately 20,000 suspected ghost guns to be to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. That's a tenfold increase in these ghost guns from 2016.
And between 2016 and 2021, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms received 45,000 reports of privately made guns that were recovered by law enforcement. That included nearly 700 used in homicides or attempted homicides. The agency says it was able to trace only 1% of them. And also today, President Biden named Steve Dettelbach, a former U.S. attorney from Ohio, as his nominee to lead the ATF. The president's previous nominee was forced to withdraw amid opposition in the Senate.
There's one more action I'm taking today. There's only been one Senate who's confirmed a director of Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives in the Bureau's entire history. It used to be didn't require Senate action when I first got to the Senate. But it's only been one since it became required confirmation. This is an agency whose mission is to protect communities from violent criminals, illegal trafficking of firearms, acts of arson and bombing, and a lot more. The mission of this agency isn't controversial. It's public safety. Today, to lead and support the dedicated men and women of the AFT, I'm proud to nominate Steve Dettelbeck, excuse me, I mispronounced your name. I just, director of Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Steve is immensely qualified. He served the Department of Justice for 2 decades. He worked side by side to support the work of federal, state, and local law enforcement, including AFT agents. And one of those was his case. He was personally tried as a U.S. attorney, where the serial arsonist firebombed the courthouses and police headquarters in Mansfield, Ohio. For his work, Steve got death threats, but the defendant got 60 years. Steve also partnered with the community leaders and law enforcement to help prevent violent crime. He's worked with the police to combat domestic extremism and to take violent criminals off the street. Steve's record makes him ready on day one to lead this agency. And by the way, in 2009, the U.S. Senate unanimously confirmed him to serve as U.S. attorney. I look forward to working with the Senate to get him confirmed once again.
The National Rifle Association has criticized the new proposal, saying in a statement, quote, "An administration that's truly sincere and resolute about curbing violent crime rates would do one thing, take violent criminals off the streets immediately. Yet the Biden administration allows these criminals who kill and maim with callous and reckless abandon again and again to roam the streets of Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, and other cities, large and small, across our country without fear of prosecution or punishment." You can see today's White House event at cspan.org and also on our video app, C-SPAN Now. Today marks the first day on the job for White House COVID response coordinator Ashish Jha. He replaces Jeffrey Zients. Dr. Jha is dean of Brown University School of Public Health and has been a prominent figure in the media during the pandemic. He told NBC News today that the Biden administration does not expect any substantial changes to its masking guidance, despite an uptick in COVID-19 cases in some parts of the U.S.
So how concerned are you about this BA2 subvariant? Are we in the midst of another surge?
Yeah, it's a great question, Savannah. I am not overly concerned right now. Case numbers are rising. BA2, we were expecting this, right, because we saw this in Europe a few weeks ago. But the good news is we're coming off of still very low infection numbers. Hospitalizations right now are the lowest they have been in the entire pandemic. So we've got to watch this very carefully. Obviously, I never like to see infections rising. I think we got to be careful. But I don't think this is a moment where we have to be excessively concerned.
As you know, the mask mandate for public transportation, airplanes, airports, trains, and the like, that is set to expire next week. Do you still support that, or do you think that perhaps the mask mandate should be extended for public transportation in light of these rising cases?
Yeah, this is a good, really good question. This is a decision that the CDC director, Dr. Walensky, is going to make. I know the CDC is working on developing a scientific framework for how to answer that. We're going to see that framework come out, I think, in the next few days. And based on that, we're going to want to be guided by this decision. You know, throughout the entire pandemic, we've wanted to make decisions based on the evidence and science. And that is what I expect we'll do again this week.
Let me just ask you, Dr. Jha, does that mean that extending the mask mandate in public transportation is a live option? It's on the table?
Yeah, I look, this is a CDC decision, and I think it is absolutely on the table. And Dr. Walensky is going to make her decision based on the framework that the CDC scientists create, and we'll make a decision collectively based on that.
New White House COVID response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha speaking to NBC News. And earlier today, C-SPAN talked to Washington Post reporter Tyler Pager about the use of masks and other COVID precautions at the White House.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. And so the mask mandate remains not in effect at the White House. The White House is very diligent to follow CDC guidelines, and the CDC updated its guidance a few weeks ago and it put out new standards for determining when to wear a mask. And so as we've seen, the president and his aides and top staff are largely unmasked throughout the White House. We saw on Friday with the celebration for the confirmation of now Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson that no one was wearing a mask, given that was outside. And so that is the status quo. But I would say that we are, after a spate of cases throughout the administration and through Washington, we have seen signs that some people are putting masks back on in certain scenarios. For example, over the weekend as President Biden traveled back to Wilmington, Delaware. We saw him in a mask there. So I think it's a case-by-case scenario, but in terms of blanket guidance, there is no mask mandate required on the White House campus at this time.
Do you have to have a test to enter the White House grounds at this point, or proof of vaccination?
You do not have to have a test to just enter the White House. For example, if I were to go to the White House press briefing, I would not need to be tested. But if I was part of the journalists in the pool following the president, whether that's going into the Oval Office for a pool spray, traveling on Air Force One, or just being in close quarters with him, you still need to test and be negative to do so.
Well, Mr. Pager, the president came back from Delaware this morning. What's on his White House agenda this week?
Yeah, so this is quite a big week for the president, given the travel that he is doing for the past few weeks. We've seen him intently focused on the war in Ukraine. Obviously, he went overseas to Europe, to Brussels and Warsaw, related to engagements on diplomacy with the war. But this week is a lot of domestic travel, something we haven't seen the president do quite so much. Tomorrow, he's traveling to Iowa. And then on Thursday, he'll be traveling to North Carolina. This was something at the end of last year he signaled he would be doing more of. Obviously, as cases of COVID rose over the holidays, and then the war in Ukraine broke out, that has distracted him from being able to focus on his domestic agenda and getting outside of Washington. But that is the big focus this week with these two trips, and both the areas that Democrats see as critically important in the midterms. In Iowa, he's going to Representative Sidney Axne's district, who is up for a tough reelection. And then in North Carolina, there's obviously the pivotal Senate race where Democrats hope to pick up a seat there.
Will he be doing political events along with his Build Back Better speeches and his economic speeches?
So these are just more policy-focused addresses, not political at this point. But I think the location of where he's going and the tenor of his message will be very much political. But we have not seen him wrap up the political schedule that he said he would. I expect in the coming months we'll see some more of that politically-focused travel.
Well, Mr. Pager, there's a headline this morning in the Hill newspaper: bad economic news haunts Democrats ahead of midterms. It says that an NBC News survey found that a huge 63% of the population disapproved of President Biden's handling of the economy. Are you hearing reaction to that in the press briefing room and by the events that Mr. Biden is scheduling?
Yeah, I think the economy is a major concern for Democrats. Speaking to my sources inside the administration, they recognize that as inflation continues to increase, it is a problem for the party ahead of midterms that were already going to be difficult, just given historical trends where the incumbent's party usually does not fare so well in the midterms. And for a lot of people, the economy is the number one issue. And so as prices rise, that becomes difficult for many American families. At the same time, the administration has touted other indicators of a strong economy, particularly around unemployment and job growth. But I think they are struggling at times to find the right message to speak to the American people about the difficult economic situation that many Americans face. I think we will hear the president, as he travels around the country, speak directly to this issue. We've seen different messaging strategies come out of this White House, from blaming the rising gas prices on Putin, calling it Putin's price hike. We'll see how much salience that argument has with the American people. But I think this is something that the White House knows is a liability coming into November's elections and are trying to get out in front of it as much as they can. But at the same time, there's limited progress they can make in terms of the economic front to deal with the rising indicators. They've always said inflation is a problem that the Federal Reserve has to deal with, but it doesn't look like there's a short-term fix or any short-term alleviation in the coming months that is going to rectify a situation that many Americans say is hurting their bottom line and their pocketbooks.
The Washington Post, Tyler Pager on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. You can see more at cspan.org and on our C-SPAN Now video app. You're listening to Washington Today.
Listen to C-SPAN Radio with our free mobile app, C-SPAN Now. Get complete access to what's happening in Washington, wherever you are, with live streams of floor proceedings and hearings from the U.S. Congress. White House events, the courts, campaigns, and more. Plus analysis of the world of politics with our informative podcasts. C-SPAN Now is available at the Apple Store and Google Play. Download it for free today. C-SPAN Now, your front row seat to Washington, anytime, anywhere.
Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some more headlines. Pacific Gas and Electric has agreed to pay more than $55 million to avoid criminal prosecution for two major wildfires started by aging Northern California power lines. According to two settlements reached with California prosecutors, PG&E admits no wrongdoing for last year's Dixie Fire and 2019's Kincade Fire, but the deals expedite damage payments to the hundreds of people whose homes were destroyed in those fires. French President Emmanuel Macron declared Monday that he wants to, quote, convince a broad range of French voters to back his centrist vision, kicking off a two-week battle against far-right challenger Marine Le Pen ahead of the country's presidential runoff vote. Meanwhile, Le Pen is highlighting rising prices for energy and food that have hit poorer households especially hard recently. The two candidates came out on top in Sunday's first round presidential vote, setting up an April 24th rematch of their 2017 campaign. And in Pakistan's parliament on Monday, elected opposition leader Shehbaz Sharif as its new prime minister, following the weekend ouster of former prime minister Imran Khan. Khan is a former cricket star whose conservative ideology and independence characterized his 3 years and 8 months in office. He lost a no-confidence vote on Sunday.
Українці, українки, найсміливіші народи найкращої в світі країни. Завершується ще один тиждень нашої боротьби.
That's Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky asking South Korean lawmakers for military aid. In a video address, Zelensky said, quote, "The Republic of Korea has tanks, ships, and various equipment that can block Russian missiles, and we would be grateful if the Republic of Korea could help us fight back against Russia." Now, despite being part of the U.S.-led international sanctions, South Korea's defense ministry has rejected a Ukrainian request for anti-aircraft weapons, citing its desire to only send non-lethal assistance. President Zelensky also talked about the conditions in the city of Mariupol, saying the city, quote, has been blocked by Russian troops since March 1st. It was a city of 500,000 people. The occupiers blocked it and did not even allow food and water to be brought there. He also added, quote, that they tried to capture it in the most brutal way, just to destroy everything in the city. Mariupol is destroyed. There are tens of thousands of dead. But even so, the Russians are not stopping the offensive. They want to make Mariupol a showcase of a ruined city. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and a bipartisan group of House members traveled this weekend to Poland. Joining Leader McCarthy were Minority Whip Steve Scalise, Foreign Affairs Ranking Member Michael McCaul, Intelligence Committee Ranking Member Michael Turner, along with four other Republican House members and two Democrats, Kathleen Rice of New York and Stephanie Murphy of Florida. The delegation met with Ukrainian and U.S. soldiers, the Polish Prime Minister and Defense Minister, and the U.S. Ambassador to Poland, Mark Brzezinski. Leader McCarthy said in a statement that the delegation's visits should, quote, serve as a powerful message to Putin that we condemned his unprovoked attacks. And at the Pentagon today, spokesman John Kirby said military assistance to Ukraine continues to flow in from the U.S. and other countries. Mr. Kirby also talked about the new Russian general leading the Ukraine invasion and what appears to be Russia refocusing its efforts on eastern Ukraine.
Two quick questions. Earlier today, President Zelensky talked about what he said was the death toll in Mariupol. He said tens of thousands. I know you don't go into numbers, but does that scale sound plausible?
It could be, Idris. We don't know. And I don't think anybody's really going to know until Ukrainian authorities are able to get in there and look and see. It's still being fought over. So it's still contested. It's still contested territory. But if you just look at the imagery and you see how much the Russians have pounded Mariupol from the air, it's inconceivable to imagine that there aren't going to be civilian casualties and that it could be a significant number. But I think we just need to not be jumping to conclusions here while the city is still being fought over.
And secondly, Jake Sullivan over the weekend talked about the new Russian general to sort of lead the war effort. Is that in any way a sign that President Putin has accepted that it's not going well and he sort of needs to readjust in some way, shape, or form?
I don't think Mr. Putin needs many signs that it hasn't been going well for him in Ukraine. I mean, here we are, day 46, and again, you know, he failed to achieve so many of his geographic and strategic objectives inside Ukraine. So they're repositioning, they're refocusing on the Donbass. I'll let them speak to their personnel announcements, but it wouldn't surprise anybody that they're trying to organize themselves better for a now more geographically confined and more specific set of target objectives now in the Donbass specifically and in the south. What I would just hasten to offer is that the Ukrainians have been for 8 years and still are fighting over that. That's still part of Ukraine, and they show no signs of being willing to give that territory up, nor should they. So we'll have to see, you know, how this plays out, but whatever the Russian plans are, whatever their goals for this new commander are, they're still going to have to reckon with a very stiff, very effective, very capable, and quite frankly, I've used this word before, but very nimble Ukrainian defense.
Pentagon spokesman John Kirby earlier today. According to the New York Times, Ukraine has lost at least $1.5 billion in grain exports since the war began. And international sanctions have also disrupted supplies from Russia, the world's leading grain exporter. At an event today sponsored by the German Marshall Fund, Cindy McCain, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Agencies for Food and Agriculture, and the wife of the late Senator John McCain, talked about the impact Russia's invasion is having on other countries.
Jill. So let's go, you know, as you said, you do not want to be the person on the front line who is telling a mother that you have no food for her to feed her children or for, you know, hungry villages. So let's play wish list, right? Let's play if I could run the world make things possible tomorrow, what would you hope would be European policies? What would you hope would be American policies to deal with what we believe is going to be an ongoing and I mean, I think tragically serious global food crisis? Mm-hmm.
Well, you touched upon something very, very dear, near and dear, obviously, is what, you know, a wish list. What can we do? Well, there's plenty of things I would wish for. I would wish for more seeds. I'd wish for more ability to be able to plant the crops, to harvest the crops, more ability to transport it out of there. There is only one way that we can gain our wish list on any of this, and that is for Vladimir Putin to stop the bombing, withdraw the troops, and give the Ukraine back to the Ukrainian people. That's the only way out of this. And until we can make that happen, or he decides it would be the wisest thing to do, we're in a real mess here. And the Ukrainian people, as you know, 4.5, probably closer to 5 million now have exited Ukraine. And as you said, this is generational. This is going to go on for years and years and years and into generations to come before this country can be put back together.
Cindy McCain, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Agencies for Food and Agriculture, speaking with former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp at an event at the German Marshall Fund. You can find this entire event at C-SPAN.org and at our C-SPAN Now video app. Also today, Israeli Ambassador to the U.S. Michael Herzog discussed recent terrorist attacks in Israel, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Iran nuclear deal, and relations between Israel and other Arab nations. This was during a virtual discussion with the Washington Post. He talked about Israel's position mediating talks between Russia and Ukraine.
First, let me state here that from the beginning of this war, Israel unequivocally stated that it is against the Russian attack on Ukraine, against upsetting international norms, and against going against any territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. And we've provided a lot of assistance, humanitarian ones, also opened a field hospital a while ago inside Ukraine, manned by Israelis, which has treated over 1,500 Ukrainians to date. Our prime minister decided at one point to try his hand as mediation. He was asked by some international leaders, especially senior European leaders who intervene and see if there is a potential diplomatic outcome, which is why he engaged both parties. All his moves were closely coordinated with the U.S. administration, and he talked to Zelensky before and after each and every move that he has taken. My understanding is today this has not produced any breakthrough. At one point, the Ukrainian leadership asked our prime minister to convene a meeting between the parties in Jerusalem. That hasn't happened. Right now, I don't see a diplomatic outcome in the cards in the foreseeable future. So unfortunately, we are in probably for a prolonged war.
Ambassador Herzog also talked about last week's shooting by a Palestinian man in a crowded bar in central Tel Aviv that killed three people and wounded 10 others. It was the fourth deadly attack in Israel by a Palestinian in less than 3 weeks.
We had a wave of four terror attacks inside Israel, which claimed the lives of 13 Israelis. They are not connected directly to each other. The two first perpetrators were people who are known to have, who are identified with ISIS, and the two others were people, young people from the West Bank who entered Israel and carried out terror attacks in the heart of Tel Aviv. We do not have any information suggesting that there was an organizational hand in the sense that some organization sent them or gave them orders. It's more a lone wolf attacks, and in such cases, there's this phenomenon of atmosphere where people, other young people who look at perpetrators of terror attacks are inspired by them and want to copy them. So that's probably what happened. Our security forces are determined to take action to stem this tide. And in order to do that, since some of the perpetrators came from the northern part of the West Bank, Israeli security forces went there in order to take action against people there who were planning further terror attacks against Israel. We've had a wave of lone attackers a few years back, and we managed to deal with it. And I'm confident that this time, too, our security forces will deal with it properly.
But at the same time, Mr. Ambassador, the Palestinian Prime Minister is accusing Israel of further escalating the situation, especially now in the holy month of Ramadan. What do you say about that, that in fact the actions of your defense forces might escalate the situation even further and led to more attacks happening against Israel?
It is regrettable that the Palestinian Prime Minister pours fuel on the fire. We didn't start these attacks. They were perpetrated by people who went into the heart of Israel and killed innocent civilians. And I would expect the Palestinian leadership to issue a stronger condemnations and not just accuse our forces. Our forces went into Jenin to seize a group of several terrorists who were planning further attacks inside Israel. There were armed people who were on the way to carry terror attacks against Israel. So I would expect the Palestinian Authority to speak against them and not against those who take action against them.
Israeli Ambassador Michael Herzog speaking with the Washington Post's Suad Mekhemet. You can see that event at cspan.org and also on our C-SPAN Now video app. And a reminder that Washington Today is available as a podcast. You can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Starikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day we take your calls live on the air on the news of the day, and we discuss policy issues that impact you. Coming up Tuesday morning, we'll discuss the Biden administration's tax policies and alternative proposals with the American Enterprise Institute's Kyle Pomerleau and Matthew Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Also, we'll talk about the shifting global balance between democracies and autocracies with Annie Boyajian of Freedom House. Watch Washington Journal live at 7 Eastern Tuesday morning on C-SPAN or on C-SPAN Now, our free mobile app. Join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, texts, and tweets.